But now, when he'd take off his new white beaver and make a bow and do a smile, he looked that grand and good and pious that you'd say he'd walked right out of the ark, and maybe was old Leviticus himself. Jim cleaned up the canoe, and I got paddle ready. There was a big steamboat laying at the shore way up under the point, about 3 miles above town. Been there a couple of hours, taking on freight. Says the king,
"Seeing how I'm dressed, I reckon maybe I better arrive down from St. Louis or Cincinnati, or some other big place. Go for the steamboat, Huckleberry. We'll come down to the village on her."
I didn't have to be ordered twice to go and take a steamboat ride. I fetched the shore 1/2 mile above the village and then went scooting along the bluff bank in the easy water. Pretty soon we come to a nice, innocent-looking young country Jake setting on a log swabbing the sweat off his face, for it was powerful warm weather, and he had a couple of big carpet bags by him.
"Run her nose inshore," says the king.
I done it.
"Where are you bound for, young man?"
"For the steamboat, going to Orleans."
"Get aboard," says the king. "Hold on a minute. My servant'll help you with them bags. Jump out and help the gentleman, Adolphus."
Meaning me, I see. I done so, and then we all three started on again. The young chap was mighty thankful, said it was tough work toting his bag in such weather. He asked the king where he was going, and the king told him he'd come down the river and landed at the other village this morning, and now he was going up a few mile to see an old friend on a farm up there. The young fellow says,
"When I first see you, I says to myself, it's Mr. Wilkes, sure, and he come mighty near getting here in time. But then I says again, no, I reckon it ain't him, or else he wouldn't be paddling up the river. You ain't him, are you?"
"No, my name's Blodgett, Alexander Blodgett. Reverend Alexander Blodgett, I suppose I must say, as I'm one of the Lord's poor servants. But still, I'm just as able to be sorry for Mr. Wilkes for not arriving in time, all the same, if he's missed anything by it, which I hope he hasn't."
"Well, he don't miss any property by it, because he'll get that all right, but he's missed seeing his brother Peter die, which he mayn't mind, nobody can tell us to that. But his brother would have give anything in this world to see him before he died. Never talked about nothing else all these 3 weeks. Hadn't seen him since they was boys together. And hadn't ever seen his brother William at all. That's the deaf and dumb one. William ain't more than 30 or 35. Peter and George was the only ones that come out here. George was the married brother. Him and his wife both died last year. Harvey and William's the only ones that's left now. And as I was saying, they haven't got here in time."
"Did anybody send them word?"
"Oh, yes, 1 or 2 ago, when Peter was first took. Because Peter said then that he sort of felt like he weren't going to get well this time. You see, he was pretty old, and George's girls was too young to be much company for him, except Mary Jane, the red-headed one. And so he was kinder lonesome after George and his wife died, and didn't seem to care much to live. He most desperately wanted to see Harvey and William, too, for that matter, because he was one of them kind that can't bear to make a will. He left a letter behind for Harvey and said he'd told in it where his money was hid and how he wanted the rest of the property divided up so George's girls would be all right. For George didn't leave nothing, and that letter was all they could get him to put a pen to."
"Why do you reckon Harvey don't come? Where does he live?"
"Oh, he lives in England. Sheffield. Preaches there. Hasn't even been in this country. He hasn't had any too much time. And besides, he mightn't have got the letter at all, you know."
"Too bad. Too bad he couldn't have lived to see his brothers, poor soul. You going to Orleans, you say?"
"Yes, but that ain't only a part of it. I'm going in a ship next Wednesday for Rio Janeiro, where my uncle lives."
"It's a pretty long journey. But it'll be lovely. I wished I was a-going. Is Mary Jane the oldest? How old is the others?"
"Mary Jane's 19, Susan's 15, and Joanna's about 14. That's the one that gives herself to good works and has a hair lip."
"Poor things, to be left alone in the cold world so."
"Well, they could be worse off. Old Peter had friends, and they ain't going to let them come to no harm. There's Hobson, the Baptist preacher, and Deacon Lot Hovey, and Ben Rucker, and Abner Shackelford, and Levi Bell, the lawyer, and Dr. Robinson, and their wives, and the widow Bartley, and, well, there's a lot of them, but these are the ones that Peter was thickest with, and used to write about sometimes when he wrote home. So Harvey'll know where to look for friends when he gets here. Well, the old man, he went on asking questions till he just fairly emptied that young fellow. Blamed if he didn't inquire about everybody and everything in that blessed town, and all about all the Wilkses, and about Peter's business, which was a tanner, and about George's, which was a carpenter, and about Harvey's, which was a dissentering minister, and so on and so on. And then he says, "What did you want to walk all the way up to the steamboat for?" "Because she's a big Orleans boat, and I was afeard she mightn't stop there. When they're deep, they won't stop for a hail. A Cincinnati boat will, but this is a St. Louis one."
"Was Peter Wilkes well off?"
"Oh, yes, pretty well off. He had houses and land, and it's reckoned he left 3 or 4 thousand in cash hid up somewheres."
"When did you say he died?"
"I didn't say, but it was last night."
"Funeral tomorrow, likely?"
"Yes, about the middle of the day."
"Well, it's all terrible sad.
But we've all got to go, one time or another.
So what we want to do is to be prepared. Then we're all right."
"Yes, sir, it's the best way. Ma used to always say that." When we struck the boat, she was about done loading, and pretty soon she got off. The king never said nothing about going aboard, so I lost my ride after all. When the boat was gone, the king made me paddle up another mile to a lonesome place, and then he got ashore and says,
"Now hustle back, right off, and fetch the Duke up here, and the new carpet bags. And if he's gone over to the other side, go over there and get him, and tell him to get himself up regardless. Shove along now."
I see what he was up to, but I never said nothing, of course. When I got back with the Duke, we hid the canoe, and then they sat down on a log, and the king told them everything, just like the young fellow had said it. Every last word of it. And all the time he was doing it, he tried to talk like an Englishman, and he done it pretty well, too, for a slouch. I can't imitate him, so I ain't a-going to try to. But he really done it pretty good. Then he says,
"How are you on the deaf and dumb, Bilgewater?"
The Duke said leave him alone for that, said he had played a deaf and dumb person on the histrionic boards. So then they waited for a steamboat. About the middle of the afternoon, a couple of little boats come along, but they didn't come from high enough up the river. But at last there was a big one, and they hailed her. She sent out her yawl, and we went aboard, and she was from Cincinnati. And when they found we only wanted to go 4 or 5 mile, they was boomin' mad, and give us a cussing, and said they wouldn't land us. But the king was calm. He says,
"If a gentleman can afford to pay $1 a mile apiece to be took on and put off in a yawl, a steamboat can afford to carry him, can't it?"
So they softened down and said it was all right, and when we got the village, they yawled us ashore. About 2 dozen men flocked down when they see the yawl a-coming, and when the king says,
"Can any of you gentlemen tell me where Mr. Peter Wilkes lives?"
They give a glance at one another and nodded their heads, as much as to say, "What I tell you?" Then one of them says, kind of soft and gentle, "I'm sorry, sir, but the best we can do is to tell you where he did live yesterday evening." Sudden as a winkin', the ornery old creeter went all to smash and fell up against the man and put his chin on his shoulder and cried down his back and says,
"Alas, alas, our poor brother, gone, and we never got to see him. Oh, it's too hard."
Then he turns around, blubbering, and makes a lot of idiotic signs to the Duke on his hands, and blamed if he didn't drop a carpet bag and bust out a-crying. If they weren't the beatenest lot, them two frauds, that ever I struck. Well, the men gathered around and sympathized with them, and said all sorts of kind things to them, and carried their carpet bags up the hill for them, and let them lean on them and cry, and told the king all about his brother's last moments, and the king, he told it all over again on his hands to the duke. And both of them took on about that dead tanner like they'd lost the 12 disciples. Well, if ever I struck anything like it, I'm a nigger. It was enough to make a body ashamed of the human race.
Chapter 25. The news was all over town in 2 minutes, and you could see the people tearing down on the run from every which way, some of them putting on their coats as they come. Pretty soon, we was in the middle of a crowd, and the noise of the tramping was like a soldier march. The windows and dooryards was full, and every minute somebody would say over a fence, "Is it them?" And somebody trotting along with the gang would answer back and say, "You bet it is." When we got to the house, the street in front of it was packed, and the three girls was standing in the door. Mary Jane was red-headed, but that don't make no difference. She was most awful beautiful, and her face and her eyes was all lit up like glory. She was so glad her uncles was come. The king, he spread his arms, and Mary Jane, she jumped for them, and the hare-lip jumped for the duke, and there they had it. Everybody most, leastways women, cried for joy to see them meet again at last and have such good times. Then the king, he hunched the duke, private. I see him do it. And then he looked around and see the coffin over in the corner on 2 chairs. So then him and the duke, with a hand across each other's shoulder and t'other hand to their eyes, walked slow and solemn over there, everybody dropping back to give them room, and all the talk and noise stopping, people saying, "Shh," and all the men taking their hats off and drooping their heads, so you could have heard a pin fall. And when they got there, they bent over and looked in the coffin, and took one side, and then they bust out a-crying so you could have heard them to Orleans most. And then they put their arms around each other's necks and hung their chins over each other's shoulders. And then, for 3 minutes, or maybe 4, I never see 2 men leak the way they done. And mind you, everybody was doing the same. And the place was that damp, I never seen anything like it. Then one of them got on one side of the coffin, and t'other on t'other side, and they kneeled down and rested their foreheads on the coffin, and led on to pray all to theirselves. Well, when it come to that, it worked the crowd like you never see anything like it, and so everybody broke down and went to sobbing right out loud. The poor girls, too, and every woman nearly went up to the girls without saying a word and kissed them solemn on the forehead and then put their hand on their head and looked up towards the sky with the tears running down and then busted out and went off sobbing and swabbing and give the next woman a show. I never seen anything so disgusting. Well, by and by, the king, he gets up and comes forward a little and works himself up and slobbers out a speech, all full of tears and flapdoodle about its being a sore trial for him and his poor brother to lose the diseased, and to miss seeing diseased alive after the long journey of 4,000 mile, but it's a trial that's sweetened and sanctified to us by this dear sympathy and these holy tears, and so he thanks them out of his heart and out of his brother's heart, because out of their mouths they can't. Words being too weak and cold, and all that kind of rotten slush, till it was just sickening. And then he blubbers out a pious goody-goody amen, and turns himself loose and goes to crying fit to bust. And the minute the words was out of his mouth, somebody over in the crowd struck up the doxologer, and everybody joined in with all their might. And it just warmed you up and made you feel as good as church letting out. Music is a good thing. And after all that soul butter and hogwash, I never see it freshen up things so, and sound so honest and bully. Then the king begins to work his jaw again, and says how him and his nieces would be glad if a few of the main principal friends of the family would take supper here with them this evening, and help set up with the ashes of the diseased, and say if his poor brother laying yonder could speak, he knows who he would name, for they was names that was very dear to him, and mentioned often in his letters. And so he will name the same, to wit, as follows, viz. Reverend Mr. Hobson, and Deacon Lot Hovey, and Mr. Ben Rucker, and Abner Shackelford, and Levi Bell, and Dr. Robinson and their wives, and the Widow Bartley.
Reverend Hobson and Dr. Robinson was down to the end of the town, a-hunting together. That is, I mean the doctor was shipping a sick man to the other world, and the preacher was pinting him right. Lawyer Bell was away up to Louisville on some business. But the rest was on hand, and so they all come and shook hands with the king and thanked him and talked to him. And then they shook hands with the duke, and didn't say nothing, but just kept a-smiling and a-bobbing their heads like a passel of sapheads, whilst he made all sorts of signs with his hands, and said, "Goo, goo, 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 goo," all the time, like a baby that can't talk. So the king, he blatted along, and managed to inquire about pretty much everybody and dog in town by his name, and mentioned all sorts of little things that happened one time or another in the town, or to George's family, or to Peter. And he always let on that Peter wrote him the things, but that was a lie. He got every blessed one of them out of that young flathead that we canoed up to the steamboat. Then Mary Jane, she fetched the letter her father left behind, and the king, he read it out loud and cried over it. It gave the dwelling house and $3,000 gold to the girls, and it gave the tan yard, which was doing a good business, along with some other houses and land, worth about $7,000, and $3,000 in gold to Harvey and William, and told where the $6,000 cash was hid down cellar. So these two frauds said they'd go and fetch it up and have everything square and above board, and told me to come with a candle. We shut the cellar door behind us, and when they found the bag, they spilt it out on the floor, and it was a lovely sight, all them yaller boys. My, the way the king's eyes did shine. He slaps the duke on the shoulder and says, "Oh, this ain't bully nor nothing. Oh, no, I reckon not. Why, Bilgey, it beats the nonsuch, don't it?" The duke allowed it did. They pawed the yaller boys and sifted them through their fingers and let them jingle down on the floor. And the king says, "It ain't no use talking. Being brothers to a rich dead man and representatives of furrin heirs that's got left is the line for you and me, Bilge. This year comes of trusting to Providence. It's the best way in the long run. I've tried 'em all, and there ain't no better way." Most everybody would have been satisfied with the pile and took it on trust, but no, they must count it. So they counts it, and it comes out $415 short. Says the king, "Dern him. I wonder what he done with that $415. They worried over that a while and ransacked all around for it. Then the duke says, "Well, he was a pretty sick man, and likely he made a mistake. I reckon that's the way of it. The best way's to let it go and keep still about it. We can spare it." "Oh, shucks. Yes, we can spare it. I don't care nothing about that. It's the count I'm thinking about. We want to be awful square and open and above board here, you know. We want to lug this here money upstairs and count it before everybody. Then there ain't nothing suspicious. But when the dead man says there's $6,000, you know, we don't want to." "Hold on," says the duke. "Let's make up the deficit." And he begun to haul out yaller boys out of his pocket. "It's a most amazing good idea, Duke. You have got a rattling clever head on you," says the king. "Blessed if the old nonsuch ain't a-heppin' us out again." And he begun to haul out yaller jackets and stack them up. It most busted them, but they made up the $6,000 clean and clear. "Say," says the duke, "I got another idea. Let's go upstairs and count this money, and then take and give it to the girls." "Good land, Duke, let me hug you. It's the most dazzling idea at ever a man struck. You have certainly got the most astonishing head I ever see. Oh, this is the boss dodge, there ain't no mistake about it. Let 'em fetch along their suspicions now if they want to. This'll lay 'em out." When we got upstairs, everybody gathered around the table, and the king, he counted it and stacked it up, $300 in a pile, 20 elegant little piles. Everybody looked hungry at it and licked their chops. Then they raked it into the bag again, and I see the king begin to swell himself up for another speech. He says, "Friends all,
My poor brother that lays yonder, has done generous by them that's left behind in the Vale of Sores. He has done generous by these poor little lambs that he loved and sheltered, and that's left fatherless and motherless. Yes, and we that knowed him knows that he would have done more generous by him if he hadn't been afeard of wounding his dear William and me. Now, wouldn't he? There ain't no question about it in my mind. Well, then, what kind of brothers would it be that had stand in his way at such a time? And what kind o' uncles would it be that had rob, yes, rob, such poor sweet lambs as these, that he loved so, at such a time? If I know William, and I think I do, I'll just ask him. He turns around and begins to make a lot of signs to the Duke with his hands. And the Duke, he looks at him stupid and leather-headed a while. Then all of a sudden, he seems to catch his meaning and jumps for the king, goo-gooing with all his might for joy, and hugs him about 15 times before he lets up. Then the king says, "I knowed it. I reckon that'll convince anybody the way he feels about it. Here, Mary Jane, Susan, Joe Alder, take the money. Take it all. It's the gift of him that lays yonder, cold but joyful." Mary Jane, she went for him. Susan and the Harelip went for the Duke. And then such another hugging and kissing I never see yet. And everybody crowded up with the tears in their eyes, and most shook the hands off of them frauds, saying all the time, "You dear good souls! How lovely! How could you?" Well, then, pretty soon all hands got to talking about the diseased again, and how good he was, and what a loss he was, and all that. And before long, a big iron-jawed man worked himself in there from outside, and stood a-listening and looking, and not saying anything, and nobody saying anything to him either, because the king was talking and they was all busy listening. The king was saying, in the middle of something he'd started in on, "They being particular friends o' the diseased. That's why they're invited here this evening. But tomorrow we want all to come. Everybody. For he respected everybody. He liked everybody. And so, it's fitting that his funeral orgies she'd be public." And so he went a-mooning on and on, liking to hear himself talk. And every little while he fetched in his funeral orgies again, till the Duke he couldn't stand it no more. So he writes on a little scrap of paper, "Obsequies, you old fool," and folds it up and goes to goo-gooing and reaching it over people's heads to him. The king, he reads it and puts it in his pocket and says, "Poor William, afflicted as he is, his heart's all as right, asks me to invite everybody to come to the funeral. Wants me to make 'em all welcome, but he needn't a worried. It was just what I was at." Then he weaves along again, perfectly calm, and goes to dropping in his funeral orgies again every now and then, just like he'd done before. And when he'd done it the third time, he says, "I say orgies, not because it's the common term, because it ain't. Obsequies being the common term, but because orgies is the right term. Obsequies ain't used in England no more now. It's gone out. We say orgies now in England. Orgies is better because it means the thing you're after more exact. It's a word that's made up out in the Greek orgo, outside, open, abroad, and the Hebrew jizum, to plant, cover up, hence, inter. So, you see, funeral orgies is an open-air public funeral. He was the worst I ever struck. Well, the iron-jawed man, he laughed right in his face. Everybody was shocked. Everybody says, "Why, doctor?" And Abner Shackelford says, "Why, Robinson, hain't you heard the news? This is Harvey Wilkes." The king, he smiled eager and shoved out his flapper and says, "Is it my poor brother's dear good friend and physician? Keep your hands off of me," says the doctor. "You talk like an Englishman, don't you? It's the worst imitation I ever heard. You, Peter Wilkes' brother, you're a fraud, that's what you are." Well, how they all took on. They crowded around the doctor and tried to quiet him down, and tried to explain to him and tell him how Harvey'd showed in 40 ways that he was Harvey, and knowed everybody by name and the names of the very dogs, and begged him not to hurt Harvey's feelings and the poor girl's feelings and all that. But it weren't no use. He stormed right along and said any man that pretended to be an Englishman and couldn't imitate the lingo no better than what he did was a fraud and a liar. The poor girls was hanging to the king and crying, and all of a sudden the doctor ups and turns on them. He says, "I was your father's friend, and I'm your friend, and I warn you as a friend and an honest one that wants to protect you and keep you out of harm and trouble, to turn your backs on that scoundrel and have nothing to do with him, the ignorant tramp, with his idiotic Greek and Hebrew, as he calls it. He is the thinnest kind of an impostor, has come here with a lot of empty names and facts which he has picked up somewheres, and you take them for proofs, and are helped to fool yourselves by these foolish friends here who ought to know better. Mary Jane Wilkes, you know me for your friend, and for your unselfish friend, too. Now listen to me. Turn this pitiful rascal out. I beg you to do it. Will you?" Mary Jane straightened herself up, and my, but she was handsome. She says, "Here is my answer." She hove up the bag of money and put it in the king's hands and says, "Take this $6,000 and invest it for me and my sisters any way you want to, and don't give us no receipt for it." Then she put her arm around the king on one side, and Susan and the hare lip done the same on the other. Everybody clapped their hands and stomped on the floor like a perfect storm, whilst the king held up his head and smiled proud. The doctor says, "All right, I wash my hands of the matter. But I warn you all that a time's coming when you're going to feel sick whenever you think of this day." And away he went. "All right, doctor," says the king, kinder mocking him. "We'll try on get him to send for you." Which made them all laugh, and they said it was a prime good hit. Chapter 26. Well, when they was all gone, the king, he asks Mary Jane how they was off for spare rooms, and she said she had one spare room which would do for Uncle William, and she'd give her own room to Uncle Harvey, which was a little bigger, and she would turn into the room with her sisters and sleep on a cot. And up garret was a little cubby with a pallet in it. The king said the cubby would do for his valley, meaning me. So Mary Jane took us up, and she showed them their rooms, which was plain but nice. She said she'd have her frocks and a lot of other traps took out of her room if they was in Uncle Harvey's way, but he said they weren't. The frocks was hung along the wall, and before them was a curtain made out of calico that hung down to the floor. There was an old hair trunk in one corner, and a guitar box in another, and all sorts of little knick-knacks and gimcracks around, like girls brisking up a room with. The king said it was all the more homely and more pleasanter for these fixins, and so don't disturb them. The duke's room was pretty small, but plenty good enough, and so was my cubby. That night they had a big supper, and all them men and women was there, and I stood behind the king and the duke's chairs and waited on them, and the niggers waited on the rest. Mary Jane, she sat at the head of the table, with Susan alongside of her,
and said how bad the biscuits was, and how mean the preserves was, and how ornery and tough the fried chicken was, and all that kind of rot, the way women always do for to force out compliments. And the people all knowed everything was tip-top, and said so, said, "How do you get biscuits so brown and nice? And where, for the land's sake, did you get these amazing pickles?" And all that kind of humbug talky-talk, just the way people always does at a supper, you know. And when it was all done, me and the hare lip had supper in the kitchen off of the leavings, whilst the others was helping the niggers clean up the things. The hare lip, she got to pumping me about England, and blessed if I didn't think the ice was getting mighty thin sometimes. She says, "Did you ever see the king?" "Who?" "William IV? Well, I bet I have. He goes to our church. I knowed he was dead years ago, but I never let on. So when I says he goes to our church, she says, "What, regular?" "Yes, regular. His pew's right over opposite on t'other side of the pulpit." "I thought he lived in London." "Well, he does. Where would he live? But I thought you lived in Sheffield." I see I was in a stump. I had to let on to get choked with a chicken bone so as to get time to think how to get down again. Then I says, "I mean, he goes to our church regular when he's in Sheffield." "That's only in the summer time when he comes there to take the sea baths." "Why, how you talk? Sheffield ain't on the sea." "Well, who said it was?" "Why, you did." "I didn't, nuther." "You did." "I didn't." "You did." "I never said nothing of the kind." "Well, what did you say then?" "Said he come to take the sea baths. That's what I said." "Well then, how's he going to take the sea baths if it ain't on the sea?" "Looky here," I says. "Did you ever see any Congress water?" "Yes." "Well, did you have to go to Congress to get it?" "Why, no." "Well, neither does William IV have to go to the sea to get a sea bath." "How does he get it, then?" "Gets it the way people down here gets Congress water, in barrels. There in the palace at Sheffield, they've got furnaces, and he wants his water hot. They can't bile that amount of water away off there at the sea. They haven't got no conveniences for it." "Oh, I see now. You might have said that in the first place and saved time." When she said that, I see I was out of the woods again, and so I was comfortable and glad. Next she says, "Do you go to church too?" "Yes, regular." "Where do you sit?" "Why, in our pew."
"Whose pew?"
"Why, ourn, your Uncle Harvey's."
"His'n?
What does he want with a pew?"
"Wants it to set in."
"What did you reckon he wanted with it?"
"Why, I thought he'd be in the pulpit."
"Rot him. I forgot he was a preacher." I see I was up a stump again, so I played another chicken bone and got another think. Then I says,
"Blame it, do you suppose there ain't but one preacher to a church?"
"Why, what do they want with more?"
"What? To preach before a king? I never seen such a girl as you. They don't have no less than 17.
17? My land! Why, I wouldn't set out such a string as that, not if I never got to glory. It must take 'em a week."
"Shucks, they don't all of them preach the same day. Only one of 'em."
"Well, then, what does the rest of 'em do?"
"Oh, nothing much. Loll around, pass the plate, and one thing or another. But mainly they don't do nothing."
"Well, then what are they for?"
"Why, they're for style. Don't you know nothing?"
"Well, I don't want to know such foolishness as that."
"How is servants treated in England? Do they treat 'em better than we treat our niggers?"
"No, a servant ain't nobody there. They treat them worse than dogs."
"Don't they give 'em holidays the way we do? Christmas and New Year's week and 4th of July?
"Oh, just listen. A body could tell you hain't ever been to England by that. Why, Harley... Why, Joanna, They never see a holiday from year's end to year's end. Never go to the circus, nor theater, nor nigger shows, nor nowheres.
Nor church?
Nor church. But you always went to church. Well, I was gone up again. I forgot I was the old man's servant. But next minute, I whirled in on a kind of an explanation how a valley was different from a common servant, and had to go to church whether he wanted to or not, and set with the family, on account of its being the law. But I didn't do it pretty good, and when I got done, I see she weren't satisfied. She says, "Honest Injun, now ain't you been telling me a lot of lies?" "Honest Injun," says I.
"None of it at all?"
"None of it at all. Not a lie in it," says I. "Lay your hand on this book and say it." I see it weren't nothing but a dictionary, so I laid my hand on it and said it. So then she looked a little better satisfied and says, "Well then, I believe some of it, but I hope to gracious if I believe the rest."
"What is it you won't believe, Joe?"
says Mary Jane, stepping in with Susan behind her.
"It ain't right nor kind of you to talk so to him, and him a stranger and so far from his people. How would you like to be treated so?" "That's always your way, ma'am, always sailing in to help somebody before they're hurt. I ain't done nothing to him. He's told some stretcher, I reckon, and I said I wouldn't swallow it all. And that's every bit and grain I did say. I reckon he can stand a little thing like that, can he? I don't care whether 'twas little or whether 'twas big. He's in our house and a stranger, and it wasn't good of you to say it. If you was in his place, it would make you feel ashamed, and so you oughtn't to say a thing to another person that will make them feel ashamed."
"Why, ma'am," he said, "it don't make no difference what he said. That ain't the thing. The thing is for you to treat him kind and not be saying things to make him remember he ain't in his own country and amongst his own folks."
I says to myself, this is a girl that I'm letting that old reptile rob of her money. Then Susan, she waltzed in, and if you'll believe me, she did give Hare Lip hark from the tomb. Says I to myself, and this is another one that I'm letting him rob of her money. Then Mary Jane, she took another inning and went in sweet and lovely again, which was her way. But when she got done, there weren't hardly anything left to poor Hare Lip. So she hollered.
"All right, then," says the other girls. "You just ask his pardon."
She done it, too, and she done it beautiful. She done it so beautiful it was good to hear, and I wished I could tell her 1,000 lies so she could do it again. I says to myself, this is another one that I'm letting him rob her of her money. And when she got through, they all just laid theirselves out to make me feel at home and know I was amongst friends. I felt so ornery and low down and mean that I says to myself, my mind's made up. I'll have that money for them or bust. So then I lit out for bed, I said, meaning sometime or another. When I got by myself, I went to thinking the thing over. I says to myself, shall I go to that doctor, private, and blow on these frauds? No, that won't do. He might tell who told him. Then the king and the duke would make it warm for me. Shall I go private and tell Mary Jane? No, I dastn't do it. Her face would give them a hint, sure. They've got the money, and they'd slide right out and get away with it. If she was to fetch in help, I'd get mixed up in the business before it was done with, I judge. No, there ain't no good way but one. I got to steal that money somehow, and I got to steal it some way that they won't suspicion that I done it. They've got a good thing here, and they ain't a-going to leave till they've played this family and this town for all they're worth. So I'll find a chance time enough. I'll steal it and hide it. And by and by, when I'm away down the river, I'll write a letter and tell Mary Jane where it's hid. But I better hive it tonight if I can, because the doctor maybe hasn't let up as much as he lets on he has. He might scare them out of here yet. So, thinks I, I'll go and search them rooms. Upstairs the hall was dark, but I found the Duke's room and started to paw around it with my hands. But I recollected it wouldn't be much like the king to let anybody else take care of that money but his own self. so then I went to his room and began to paw around there. But I see I couldn't do nothing without a candle, and I dassn't light one, of course. So I judged I'd got to do the other thing, lay for them and eavesdrop. About that time, I hear their footsteps coming, and I was going to skip under the bed. I reached for it, but it wasn't where I thought it would be. But I touched the curtain that hid Mary Jane's frocks, so I jumped in behind that and snuggled in amongst the gowns, and stood there perfectly still. They come in and shut the door, and the first thing the Duke done was to get down and look under the bed. Then I was glad I hadn't found the bed when I wanted it. And yet, you know, it's kind of natural to hide under the bed when you're up to anything private. They sets down then, and the king says,
"Well, what is it? And cut it middling short, because it's better for us to be down there a-whooping up the morning than up here giving them a chance to talk us over."
"Well, this is it, Cap'n. I ain't easy. I ain't comfortable. That doctor lays on my mind. I wanted to know your plans. I've got a notion, and I think it's a sound one."
"What is it, Duke?"
"That we'd better glide out of this before 3 in the morning and clip it down the river with what we've got. Especially seeing we got it so easy. Given back to us, flung at our heads, as you may say, when of course we allowed to have to steal it back. I'm for knocking off and lighting out." That made me feel pretty bad. About an hour or two ago, it would have been a little different, but now it made me feel bad and disappointed. The king rips out and says,
"What? And not sell out the rest of the property? March off like a passel of fools and leave $8,000 or $9,000 worth of property laying around just suffering to be scooped in? And all good saleable stuff, too."
The Duke, he grumbled. Said the bag of gold was enough, and he didn't want to go no deeper. Didn't want to rob a lot of orphans of everything they had.
"Why, how you talk," says the king. "We shan't rob them of nothing at all, but just this money. The people that buys the property is the sufferers, because as soon as it's found out we didn't own it, which won't be long after we've slid, the sale won't be valid, and it'll all go back to the estate. These your orphans'll get their house back again, and that's enough for them. They're young and spry and can easy earn a living. They ain't a-going to suffer. Why, just think. There's thousands and thousands that ain't nigh so well off. Bless you, they ain't got nothing to complain of."
Well, the king, he talked him blind. So at last he give in and said all right, but said he believed it was blame foolishness to stay and that doctor hanging over them. But the king says,
"Cuss the doctor. What do we care for him? Ain't we got all the fools in town on our side? And ain't that a big enough majority in any town?"
So they got ready to go downstairs again. The Duke says, "I don't think we put that money in a good place." That cheered me up. I'd begun to think I weren't going to get a hint of no kind to help me. The king says,
"Why?"
"Because Mary Jane'll be in mourning from this out. And first you know the nigger that does up those rooms will get an order to box these duds up and put them away. And do you reckon a nigger can run across money and not borrow some of it?"
"Your head's level again, Duke," says the king.
And he come a-fumbling under the curtain 2 or 3 foot from where I was. I stuck tight to the wall and kept mighty still, though quivery. And I wondered what them fellows would say to me if they catched me. And I tried to think what I'd better do if they did catch me. But the king, he got the bag before I could think more than about a half a thought, and he never suspicioned I was around. They took and shoved the bag through a rip in the straw tick that was under the feather bed, and crammed it in 1 or 2 amongst the straw, and said it was all right now, because a nigger only makes up the feather bed, and don't turn over the straw tick only about 2x a year, and so it weren't in no danger of getting stole now. But I knowed better. I had it out of there before they was halfway downstairs. I groped along up to my cubby and hid it there till I could get a chance to do better. I judged I better hide it outside of the house somewheres, because if they missed it, they would give the house a good ransacking. I knowed that very well. Then I turned in, with my clothes all on, but I couldn't have gone to sleep if I'd have wanted to. I was in such a sweat to get through with the business. By and by, I heard the king and the duke come up, so I rolled off of my pallet and laid with my chin at the top of my ladder and waited to see if anything was going to happen. But nothing did. So I held on till all the late sounds had quit and the early ones hadn't begun yet, and then I slipped down the ladder. Chapter 27. I crept to their doors and listened. They was snoring, so I tiptoes along and got downstairs all right. There weren't a sound anywheres. I peeped through a crack of the dining room door and see the men that was watching the corpse all sound asleep on their chairs. The door was open into the parlor where the corpse was laying, and there was a candle in both rooms. I passed along, and the parlor door was open, but I see there weren't nobody in there but the remainders of Peter. So I shoved on by. But the front door was locked, and the key wasn't there. Just then, I heard somebody coming down the stairs back behind me. I run in the parlor and took a swift look around, and the only place I see to hide the bag was in the coffin. The lid was shoved along about a foot, showing the dead man's face down in there, with a wet cloth over it and a shroud on. I tucked the money bag in under the lid, just down beyond where his hands was crossed, which made me creep, they were so cold, and then I run back across the room and in behind the door. The person coming was Mary Jane. She went to the coffin very soft and kneeled down and looked in. Then she put up her handkerchief, and I see she begun to cry, though I couldn't hear her, and her back was to me. I slid out, and as I passed the dining room, I thought I'd make sure them watchers hadn't seen me, so I looked through the crack, and everything was all right. They hadn't stirred. I slipped up to bed, feeling rather blue, on accounts of the thing playing out that way after I'd took so much trouble and run so much risk about it. Says I, if it could stay where it is, all right, because when we get down the river 100 mile or two, I could write back to Mary Jane, and she could dig him up again and get it. But that ain't the thing that's going to happen. The thing that's going to happen is the money'll be found when they come to screw on the lid. Then the king'll get it again, and it'll be a long day before he gives anybody another chance to smouch it from him. Of course, I wanted to slide down and get it out of there, but I dasn't try it. Every minute it was getting earlier now, and pretty soon some of them watchers would begin to stir, and I might get catched with $6,000 in my hand that nobody hadn't hired me to take care of. I don't wish to be mixed up in no such business as that, I says to myself. When I got downstairs in the morning, the parlor was shut up and the watchers was gone. There weren't nobody around but the family and the widow Bartley and our tribe. I watched their faces to see if anything had been happening, but I couldn't tell. Towards the middle of the day, the undertaker come, with his man, and they set the coffin in the middle of the room on a couple of chairs, and then set all our chairs in rows, and borrowed more from the neighbors, till the hall and the parlor and the dining room was full. I see the coffin lid was the way it was before, but I dasn't go to look in under it with folks around. Then the people begun to flock in, and the beats and the girls took seats in the front row at the head of the coffin. And for a half an hour the people filed around slow, in single rank, and looked down at the dead man's face a minute, and some dropped in a tear, and it was all very still and solemn, only the girls and the beats holding handkerchiefs to their eyes and keeping their heads bent and sobbing a little. There weren't no other sound but the scraping of the feet on the floor and blowing noses, because people always blow them more at a funeral than they do at other places, except church. When the place was packed full, the undertaker, he slid around in his black gloves with his softy soothering ways, putting on the last touches and getting people and things all shipshape and comfortable, and making no more sound than a cat. He never spoke. He moved people around, he squeezed in late ones, he opened up passageways, and done it all with nods and signs with his hands. Then he took his place over against the wall. He was the softest, glidingest, stealthiest man I ever see, and there weren't no more smile to him than there is to a ham. They had borrowed a melodeon, a sick one, and when everything was ready, a young woman sat down and worked it, and it was pretty squeaky and colicky, and everybody joined in and sung, and Peter was the only one that had a good thing, according to my notion. Then the Reverend Hobson opened up, slow and solemn, and begun to talk, and straight off, the most outrageous row busted out in the cellar a body ever heard. There was only one dog, but he made a most powerful racket, and he kept it up right along. The parson, he had to stand there over the coffin and wait. You couldn't hear yourself think. It was right down awkward, and nobody didn't seem to know what to do. But pretty soon they see that long-legged undertaker make a sign to the preacher, as much as to say, "Don't you worry, just depend on me." Then he stooped down and begun to glide along the wall, just his shoulders showing over the people's heads. So he glided along, and the powwow and racket getting more and more outrageous all the time, and at last, when he had gone around two sides of the room, he disappears down the cellar. Then in about 2 seconds we heard a whack, and the dog, he finished up with a most amazing howl or two, and then everything was dead still, and the parson begun his solemn talk where he left off. In a minute or two, here comes this undertaker's back and shoulders gliding along the wall again. And so he glided and glided around three sides of the room and then rose up and shaded his mouth with his hands and stretched his neck out towards the preacher over the people's heads and says, in a kind of coarse whisper, "He had a rat." Then he drooped down and glided along the wall again to his place. You could see it was a great satisfaction to the people, because naturally they wanted to know. A little thing like that don't cost nothing, and it's just the little things that makes a man to be looked up to and liked. There weren't no more popular man in town than what that undertaker was. Well, the funeral sermon was very good, but pisin' long and tiresome. And then the king, he shoved in and got off some of his usual rubbage, and at last the job was through, and the undertaker begun to sneak up on the coffin with his screwdriver. I was in a sweat then, and watched him pretty keen. But he never meddled at all, just slid the lid along as soft as mush, and screwed it down tight and fast. So there I was. I didn't know whether the money was in there or not. "So," says I, "suppose somebody has hauled that bag on the sly. Now how do I know whether to write to Mary Jane or not? Suppose she dug him up and didn't find nothing. What would she think of me?" "Blame it," I says, "I might get hunted up and jailed. I'd better lay low and keep dark and not write at all. The thing's awful mixed now. Trying to better it, I've worsened it 100 times, and I wish to goodness I'd just let it alone. Dad fetch the whole business." They buried him, and we come back home, and I went to watching faces again. I couldn't help it, and I couldn't rest easy. But nothing come of it. The faces didn't tell me nothing. The king, he visited around in the evening and sweetened everybody up and made himself ever so friendly, and he gave out the idea that his congregation over in England would be in a sweat about him, so he must hurry and settle up the estate right away and leave for home. He was very sorry he was so pushed, and so was everybody. They wished he could stay longer, but they said they could see it couldn't be done. And he said of course him and William would take the girls home with them, and that pleased everybody, too, because then the girls would be well fixed, and amongst their own relations, and it pleased the girls, too, tickled them so they clean forgot they ever had a trouble in the world, and told him to sell out as quick as he wanted to. They would be ready. Them poor things was that glad and happy, it made my heart ache to see them getting fooled and lied to so. But I didn't see no safe way for me to chip in and change the general tune. Well, blamed if the king didn't build the house and the niggers and all the property for auction straight off, sale 2 days after the funeral. But anybody could buy private beforehand if they wanted to. So the next day after the funeral, along about noontime, the girl's joy got the first jolt. A couple of nigger traders come along, and the king sold them the niggers reasonable, for 3-day drafts, as they called it, and away they went. The two sons up the river to Memphis, and their mother down the river to Orleans. I thought them poor girls and them niggers would break their hearts for grief. They cried around each other and took on so, it most made me down sick to see it. The girls said they had never dreamed of seeing the family separated or sold away from the town. I can't ever get it out of my memory, the sight of them poor miserable girls and niggers hanging around each other's necks and crying. And I reckon I couldn't have stood it all, but would have had to bust out and tell in our gang if I hadn't knowed the sale weren't no account and the niggers would be back home in a week or two. The thing made a big stir in the town, too, and a good many come out flat-footed and said it was scandalous to separate the mother and the children that way. It injured the fraud some, but the old fool, he bulled right along, spite of all the Duke could say or do, and I tell you the Duke was powerful and easy. Next day was auction day. About broad day in the morning, the King and the Duke come up in the garret and woke me up, and I see by their look that there was trouble. The King says,
"Was you in my room night before last?"
"No, Your Majesty," which was the way I always called him when nobody but our gang weren't around.
"Was you in there yesterday or last night?"
"No, Your Majesty."
"Honor bright now, no lies."
"Honor bright, Your Majesty, I'm telling you the truth. I ain't been a near your room since Miss Mary Jane took you and the Duke and showed it to you." The Duke says, "Have you seen anybody else go in there?" "No, Your Grace, not as I remember, I believe."
"Stop and think."
I studied a while and see my chance. Then I says,
"Well, I see the niggers go in there several times."